When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to a very special bonus episode on One Heat Minute Productions. I am your host and producer, Blake Howard. Look, thank you so much for your continued support. This is a very special bonus episode. I occasionally get a chance to speak to filmmakers about films that are being released rather than our normal reflective look backs on, you know, classics or underappreciated gems that we're exploring. And Scott Derrickson is a filmmaker that I have been interested in and following for about a decade. Really, for me, it wasn't his terrific Exorcism of Emily Rose that really kicked off my love affair with him as a filmmaker and as just a personality, but his movie Sinister from 2012, starring Ethan Hawke, is truly one of the a true horror masterpiece. I love it unabashedly and enduringly, and it's just a mesmerizing film that has really stuck with me and one of my favorite films of that year. His latest film, The Black Phone, adapted from the Joe Hill short story, co-written the screenplay by he and his frequent writing partner, C. Robert Cargill, a true film geek turned good, is out now in Australian theaters. It's out all over the place. It's been out in the States. It's been kicking goals, making a huge amount of cash over there, and has just hit premium video on demand in the United States. I got a chance to talk to him about his terrifically successful and deeply personal film, and I got to talk to him about his influences, and we just got to talk about a whole bunch of things, as well as, you know, iconic horror movie making of the tallest order. So this is a terrific chat. I had a terrific time talking to him. You must see The Black Phone. If you're in Oz, go see it out right now. If you're in the States, jump onto iTunes. You can buy it right now or whatever your preferred purchasing platform for video on demand, or just go and see it in the theater. It is a terrific film, beautifully personal, terrifying, great piece of genre filmmaking, produced by the great folks at Blumhouse. And I'm really thankful to Universal Pixar's for giving me the chance to talk to Scott, because he's a lovely man, and I hope you really enjoy the interview. Now, without any further ado, the terrific Scott Derrickson. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, thank you.
It's awesome to chat to you. I'm a big admirer of your work, and we're mutual friends with the great Walter Chaw. So
the one and only.
The one and only, right? So I thought, you know, there's my 6 degrees of separation for you.
You couldn't have a better link than Walter. That's good. You got your credibility just went up 10,000 points.
Well, that's good to hear. Look, I just want to say, firstly, God, I love this movie. It's terrific.
Well, given your sweatshirt and the amazing array of posters behind you, I'm taking it as a high compliment. That's great.
Oh, look, I'm glad. That's why I leave the camera on. So I was like, what sweatshirt do I wear today? Well, I'm going to talk to Scott today. Let's bring out the big
There are a lot of filmmakers who would not be as impressed by your selections behind you, but boy, you're a man after my own heart, clearly.
Listen, I know how many interviews you've done for this great film. I know how successful the film is. I know how now lucky we are in Oz to get a chance to see it on the big screen. I know it's already had a phenomenal run in the States. So congratulations on the film's success. So I'm
thanks so much.
And I also
of course, because I'm friends with Walter and I follow you both, have consumed your work there. So I'm gonna try and make this fun for us, because I'm gonna firstly ask you a couple of questions about the film. Secondly, I'm gonna then pester you,
right,
because I know you're a huge Thief fan, and we've just lost James Caan.
Oh, so yeah,
we could talk a little bit about that. And right, and then I'm going to ask you questions, because truly, I mean, I know that your Twitter is probably a hellfire for you, but as a consumer of your Twitter, I thoroughly enjoy your contribution to the discourse. So I follow you, so I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun. I can have a chat with Scott about all sorts of fun movies that he talks about and loves to talk about too, because I think, you know, I'm also... I must say, in the decade of your films, Sinister knocked my socks off. So I might start a decade ago and talk to you about Sinister and The Black Phone. For me, are like two wonderful sort of philosophical conversations. One of them is, in Sinister, is like the crisis of being a filmmaker, and The Black Phone is living in this world. So I wondered if you were, when you and your great writing partner, C. Robert Cargill, I wonder when you guys were formulating this and using Joe Hill's terrific short story as your basis, were you guys thinking of this as signposts in both of your careers? Because both of you really, you know, you'd had some other big pictures come out earlier, Dead Yes Stood Still, and then obviously Exorcism, Emily Rose. Sinister drops and it's just another level, you know, in my mind. And now... coming back to The Black Phone, did it feel like signposting? Did it feel like that's where you were in your career?
You know, I stopped thinking about my career as any kind of a little progression or having any narrative view of my career after I made The Day the Earth Stood Still. You know, Sinister was, in a lot of ways, the result of what happened to me personally as a result of making Day the Earth Stood Still. I was in the exact situation. I wrote basically the situation that I was in, where, just like Ellison Oswald, I had made this first thing, Emily Rose, I was big hit Wonder Boy. Everybody loved me. Everybody wanted me to do everything, you know, and then the follow-up, not so great, and had a really terrible experience. And I found myself, at the time that we wrote Sinister, you know, I was not very employable as a director. I really felt like Ellison Oswald, that fear of losing my status, losing my financial security, all of it. And I was kind of working out what was disappointing to me and myself, which was the level of anxiety and fear that I was feeling over things that were not the most important things in my life, you know? Yes. And that's really where that movie came from. And the decision that I made before making Sinister, and what Sinister was the result of, was, you know, making a decision that I would not think strategically about my career anymore. I just was like, I'm not going to think about, you know, do I make a bigger movie? I want to get to this level. I want to make something at this budget. I want, you know, I just stopped doing that altogether. And I made a decision that I made a decision that there were two things that were going to become mantras for me. One, I was never going to find myself at the end of somebody else's movie again, which, yes, I didn't. And that's one of the reasons I stepped off of the sequel to Doctor Strange. And secondly, I was going to make every movie as though it would be the last film I'd get to make, because one day it will be, you know, that's served me well so far, you know, and I'm really proud of the films that I've made since then. So in the case of The Black Phone, you know, when I stepped off of Multiverse of Madness, that script was a script that we had written during prep for Multiverse of Madness, and we did that because another writer was writing the first draft on that Marvel movie, and I just had a big window of time. The writer was taking a terribly long time to get a draft done, and so we just went and wrote that script, and I wasn't sure if I would end up making it or not, even when I was writing it to write it. And of course, once I did step off the Marvel movie, there it was. And it seemed very clear to me, like, oh, this is something I very much do want to make. This is a very personal screenplay. And then just pulled the trigger and immediately went and did it. So it wasn't any kind of, There was no strategy. There was no thought behind it, other than at the time that we wrote the script, it was just a very personal thing inside of me that needed to be written, you know? And so we wrote it.
Yeah. I absolutely love that. It reminds me of, I'm not sure if you've seen, Celine Sciamma did this beautiful lecture. She was describing how she writes a screenplay. And it's one of the first times, you know, being inspired by people like yourself and your great co-writer, it's one of the first times I've ever heard anyone put it out there as a way to approach writing. And I wonder if you do something similar, because she talks about having two pages on a script. On the left-hand page, say, there's all the things that need to happen in the movie. And then on the right-hand side, she writes down the scenes or the images or the moments or the influences or the music drops or whatever the case may be that she has to have in this thing to make it. And I feel right. like that in your films, like there's indelible images, indelible needle drops. There's these moments. And she says the trick is for a master like her too. The trick is making all those things that you would die without them being in the movie, being as essential as the things that you have to do. And so I wonder, you know, hearing you talk about like the desire here, and it's all about your own personal gratification and satisfaction. I think I that really resonates for me.
I wouldn't use the terms gratification or satisfaction. It's definitely much more about need. And I think that, you know, I don't know, I can't speak for other artists. I'm sure that there's a wide array of things that motivate artists' work. For me, it does come out of a need. It's a need to express that I've always had, and I think less than express is not even the right word. A need to pull something out, to find some truth that is stirring inside of me. You know, that it seems to always come from there if it's any good.
Yes.
And in this case, you know, I'd been in therapy for 3 years prior to writing The Black Phone, dealing mostly with the violence of my childhood, the violence in my household, the violence in my neighborhood. I just grew up in this, you know, working class North Denver, Colorado area that I've never seen put on film before in any way, that was really unique. And I had spent a lot of years digging down from my earliest memories, you know, up through really through high school years and dealing with a lot of the violence and the traumatic experiences that I had, you know, many of which are in the movie, some of which were too dark to put in the movie, frankly. Yeah. And what I did is I went to Cargill and I said, you know, I've been digging around this dirt so deeply, and I feel like there's something here, you know? And I started by talking to him about the possibility of making something like an American 400 Blows, you know, the way that Francis Truffaut, you know, made this movie about his childhood, you know, growing up in France. And I was interested in that, but the more I looked at it, I was like, there's no story to my childhood that's interesting. And it didn't feel like it was enough. And Cargill and I had been talking about The Black Phone for as long as we had been partners. I gave it to him very early on in our working relationship. I read that short story the month it was published, like 17 years ago.
Yeah.
And so the eureka moment was, wait a minute, what if we took, you know, all this stuff that I'm thinking about, this violent childhood, this neighborhood I grew up with, and these kids that I knew and all that, and we combine it with The Black Phone, because it was a very short story. And we never knew what to do with The Black Phone, because it was not a ready-made movie. It was like kind of like a good second act of a movie, you know? And he immediately got it. He said, that's a great fucking idea. Sorry, I don't know if I can swear on the show or not.
You sure can.
But he said that's a great idea. So we just went at, he got it very quickly, and we wrote the script in like 6 weeks. It just flowed. It was really easy to write. We wrote it very, very quickly. And I think that his, you know, his sort of massive contribution was primarily in the Gwen character. I don't remember if it was him or I, or both of us together, where it's like, we got to get a girl in this movie, you know, but he had envisioned this younger sister. His opening descriptive line of her is, Gwen is the sunshine in the apocalypse. Is how her character is described. And you know, she steals the movie. She's the strongest character in this world full of boys and men. They all come out differently and they all come from different places. And the process for me is always slightly different, if not wildly different, but that's how that one happened.
Well, just mindful of time, because I feel like you and I, if we started having a proper chin wag, we'd probably never get off this call. So I might
That's probably true. fair enough. I'll try to be a little more succinct with my responses.
I don't want you to be. I'm enjoying it too much. So I'm just going to dive into it. I'm going to take a detour. James Caan, Thief.
That movie.
Walter wrote it best, which is like all of the titans that kind of walk the earth of our past, of our youth, they're kind of passing away, and I was so moved by it. And my podcast is One Heat Minute, so we're Michael Mann acolytes, and Thief is so important to me, and Jimmy Caan is so important to me as a presence and an actor. And I saw you tweeting about it back and forth as this was going on, and I'd love just to talk to you a little bit about James Caan and particularly about Thief, because I know you love both of them so dearly.
Well, it's an important movie in my past, and he's an important, actor and movie star in my past, because the saving grace in my upbringing was that for all the various ways that I came from a fucked up family, my parents did love movies, mm-hmm. and we saw a lot of films. I saw more films than kids my age ever got to see. We would go sometimes to we'd go to a matinee and then get food and go to a double feature at the drive-in and see three movies in one long day,
Awesome.
And I remember for me, it was a combination with James Caan. It was a combination of three different experiences. One was that my parents, I was the right age for the invention of the VCR. It's like I was young when it first was happening, and my parents got a VHS player, or I think it was a beta player, and were renting movies. And that we watched The Godfather at least once a year, as I was starting to learn that there was more movies than the ones that you could just see in a theater. And seeing these great films of the past, The Godfather was the one that was just constantly playing. So I learned that movie inside out and was blown away by it, by both parts one and two. But I went to the drive-in and saw Rollerball.
Yeah.
And so wow. I saw Rollerball at the drive-in. And Rollerball,
I think it's actually made for drive-ins, that movie. It feels like you should only be able to watch it in a drive-in. Where people can honk their horns.
I do think Rollerball is the consummate drive-in movie. I think that's probably true. If I had to pick, what's the ideal drive-in movie, it's Rollerball. It's perfect for that. And so, here's this guy, this movie star who's having this impression on me. And then I think I saw Thief around the same time that it was later. It could have been early college, but it wasn't. It was fairly early in Michael Mann's career. I had not seen Manhunter, which I believe was first, but I had seen Michael Mann's made-for-TV movie called The Jericho Mile, which I was obsessed with. I used to watch that over and over and over again when I was in early high school.
Great movie.
It's one of the great.
It's one of the best sports movies ever, Scott.
So when Thief came along, my dad had already seen it. He wanted me to see it, and I still remember the experience of that movie being something that was so ineffably powerful to me because of this character. And of course, looking back, once I was in college, I became a philosophy student. I was like, "Oh, this is an existentialist movie. This is a movie about soul existential existence." But there was something about Caan's embodiment of creating meaning in a meaningless universe that spoke to me so powerfully. And so he embodied. This kind of masculinity, but there was always this deep philosophical attachment to it for me with him in the things that he did. And my dad was a pretty macho guy, so there was something, and my dad loved James Caan, fucking loved him, maybe his favorite actor. And so the imprint of that guy on my early life and on my life as a filmmaker and just, what I perceived movie stars to be was indelible, you know? And I think that I think Thief is probably, you know, it is one of the greatest films of its era. And also, just if I can just, you know, the way that James Caan embodied the physicality of that movie, the heist itself and the non-dialogue heist and the realism of it. And I'd never seen anything like that either.
I mean, hundreds of pounds of equipment, and this guy who is so rigid and powerful and he's broad in his shoulders is just, you know, thwacking these huge metallic drills and magnetic drills onto things. It's, you know, and just him sort of effortlessly doing it, like it's, I think that you're so right about the existential quality, but it's also got this blue collar, get your hands dirty quality.
When I think of that movie, I always, I tend to do this with films. Like when I think of a like when I was thinking of Rollerball, I was thinking of James Caan, full body, crossing, doing the leg cross, skating around the corners, you know, with in his full uniform and Rollerball. That's like the image that comes to mind with his team behind him. And for Thief, the image that always comes to my mind is that it's a fairly compressed kind of long lens close-up of him, but it's after they've broken into the vault and I believe his team is sort of gathering the money, and the camera just lingers on him as he sits down and his face is all dirty and he's all filthy from having broken in and ashen with blackness and he's smoking a cigarette.
I love that.
And that shot of him is that movie to me, you know, the sort of, there's a sense of satisfaction, there's a sense of meaning, there's a sense of purpose, and it's just James Caan being a badass, you know, and there's something about that is that character, and Michael Mann at his best is as good as it gets, you know, but for me it's the early Michael Mann movies that really have had the biggest impact on me, particularly The Jericho Mile, Manhunter, and Thief. Those would probably top my list of my favorites of his films.
I was going to say Manhunter, the atmospherics of Manhunter, and your film Sinister with that Christopher Young score. Like there's a couple
very, very influential movie.
I was just going to say, I mean, maybe it's why I love them both so much is that they set a tone and a mood and this kind of incongruously like loud and deafening score that kind of makes you focus on all these micro gestures. So special. But look, I just want to say, I thought The Black Phone was absolutely terrific. I know we've probably got to run in a heartbeat, but Mason was an absolute rock star. Madeline was stunning. And your leading villain, Mr. Hawk, really, like, he and Hugo Weaving have done the two best masks performances almost ever in my mind. You know, like, it's like,
yeah,
you have to be, you have to be so titanic, a huge actor, to be just completely covered up and to do everything in gesture. And, you know, without spoiling anything, there is an image that you create in this movie of Ethan Hawke sitting in a chair that I will just never forget in my life. I will just never, it is a cigarette burn in my brain forever. And, you know, to have such an indelible impact over many movies, but just to have, I think truly one of the most iconic shots in you know, contemporary horror films. I applaud you. And I just want to say thank you so much for your time. It's been a treat.
Oh, God bless you. Yeah. I already followed you on Twitter. So we're Twitter followers. Thanks so much. That was great interview. I loved it.
Oh,
thank you so
I'm
much.
So pleased. I'm so pleased. You take care. And again, like I said, congrats on all the success. I can't wait for people in Oz to get completely freaked out.
All right. Good on you. And, you know, I wish everybody a good time watching the movie. Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.